Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 130, What's Next? There are things coming that are probably inevitable, even if they may happen millions of years in the future. But even if something is inevitable, we do still have the capacity to change it. Dear Cheap Astronomy, when will the sun destroy the Earth, and can we stop it? It's currently estimated that the sun will become a red giant in about 5 billion years, puffing outwards to at least melt the surface of the Earth, if not consume it completely. However, it's expected the Earth will become uninhabitable in just 1 billion years as the steadily increasing output of the sun begins to evaporate the oceans. Water vapor is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, so that will heat the Earth even more, and also the additional CO2 that was previously dissolved in the oceans will add further to all that warming, sending our future Earth on a path to becoming the next Venus. The sun is steadily getting hotter because hydrogen is fused to helium in the sun's core, and helium takes up slightly less volume than the unfused hydrogen did. So with the outer layers of the sun still compressing inwards, the sun's core becomes denser. This increased density results in higher pressures and temperatures within the sun's core, which speeds up the sun's fusion reactions and hence generates more radiation. This is why stars with more mass than the sun have much shorter lifespans. Just like the sun, they fuse hydrogen, but their bigger mass and stronger gravity means they fuse hydrogen at a much faster rate. So they shine hotter and brighter and bluer than the sun does, but they don't last as long. At the other end of the scale, red dwarfs are the longest living stars of all, since their lower mass means that fusion in their cores runs at quite a slow rate, which means less radiation output, so they're dim and they're red, but they're very, very long-lived. So, as the sun ages, the best way to keep its output steady and constant is to reduce the mass of the outer layers that press down upon the sun's core. In this way, you could counterbalance the natural tendency of stars to get hotter and brighter as they get older. And if you keep the balance right, you could keep fusion in the sun's core continuing at a constant rate for several billion years longer than it would otherwise. You still have a problem with the whole core eventually being turned into helium. However, it's theorized that steadily reducing the sun's mass will start moving it towards the dynamics that are seen in red dwarf stars, where there's a convective movement of the star's plasma throughout the whole star, unlike the way the sun currently works, where its greater mass effectively locks the sun's core in place, so that convection can only operate in the outer layers. If there was convection throughout the sun, then the helium fused from hydrogen in the core would also be moved around by convection, meaning that you might avoid the whole red giant Earth destruction scenario, although the sun would eventually, after billions more years, dim down to a red dwarf itself. Siphoning off the sun's contents is well beyond our current engineering capabilities, but a method has been scoped out in some detail on paper, and it does seem broadly plausible if we can build the substantial infrastructure required out of some appropriately heat-resistant materials. What we'd need to do is to heat up various spots on the sun's surface to generate additional plasma outbursts, adding to the current natural output of solar wind and coronal mass ejections. While this would require a stupendous amount of energy, remember, we are working with the sun, so a stupendous amount of solar power will be readily available. Ultimately, we would just be capturing some of the sun's radiation output and then firing that back at the sun in concentrated beams. Additionally, we would need to channel this enhanced plasma output away from the Earth and other planets by setting up a magnetic ring around the sun's equator that would channel the extra upflung plasma towards the sun's poles, with further magnetic rings channeling it into two polar jets of heated plasma. The magnetic rings would be created by a ring of orbiting space stations that would exchange beams of charged ions, thereby creating a constant flowing electrical circuit around the sun that would act as an electromagnet. Again, while the engineering involved is well beyond our current technology, the general concept is based on fairly conventional physics, and a huge infrastructure investment like this might seem very worthwhile to future generations if it means prolonging the habitability of our home planet by several billion years. So, if we can find our way through the current anthropomorphic global warming challenge, this next hurdle might well be feasible too.
This is the middle bit.
Good science and clever engineering really can save the world, both now and in the future. It's important to appreciate this, since it really is just down to us to save ourselves. Well, unless, maybe.
Dear Cheap Astronomy, will we ever meet aliens? Well, we might equally ask whether aliens will ever meet us. The light speed barrier, and indeed the extreme dangers involved in travelling anywhere near the light speed barrier, means we'll be looking at journeys of hundreds, if not thousands of years, to reach another stellar system. That means either of two nightmarish scenarios. A, we send frozen eggs and sperm that are thawed out and mixed together at the destination, with those children then raised by robots and some instructional videos from home. Or B, we send a generational ship where generations of small families would live and die in a tin can before their distant progeny finally arrives at the destination. Maybe there's some undreamt of technology where we can put people in stasis, so those same people arrive fresh, bright-eyed and unaged at their destination. But before we start looking to undreamt of technologies for an answer, maybe we should just pause and consider whether it's vastly easier, safer and cheaper to just send robots. And with that said, there's not much point sending a ship full of robots. You might as well just send a ship that is a robot. In other words, when we do start exploring interstellar space, we'll be doing it with robotic probes. Although they'll have to be probes with highly autonomous decision-making abilities, since they'd otherwise be waiting tens or hundreds of years to get instructions from Earth. So they'll be quite smart robots, but with a hardwired directive to both explore and to relay their findings back home, which doesn't make them all that different from us when you think about it. And it doesn't seem likely that technologically advanced aliens are going to deal with the situation any differently. So it's likely that they'll also be touring the universe with robotic probes. And from there, it's faintly possible that our probes and their probes might meet, but it's vastly more likely that our first engagement with aliens will be via radio or some other form of electromagnetic radiation. Once we've made contact, we could then organise for our respective robotic probes to meet, but the radio delay across light years means a conversation along the lines of, "Hey, let's meet over there in 1.5 centuries, along with the hope that the other party won't come back years later with an alternate plan. In any case, there's not a huge amount of point in our robots meeting. We could just exchange detailed design schematics about them over radio, with no real concern about sharing our precious technological secrets, since by the time the aliens receive the schematics, That technology will be decades, if not centuries old, at least from our perspective. Furthermore, we may have to consider that the aliens we do eventually communicate with might not be bright-eyed novices who are quivering at the very thought of first contact. The first alien broadcast we pick up may be along the lines of, "Look, let's cut to the chase. We can't do warp speed. No one else we've talked to can either, so get over it. We'll never meet, and you'll probably never meet anyone else either. If you want to share some photos, the folks at these coordinates are building a collection. If you want to exchange technology schematics, you can try the folks over there. Although don't worry about the schematics of your robotic probes. We've all got those. And, by the way, this is an automated broadcast, so please don't reply." Of course, the first aliens we meet might not be technologically advanced. Within our solar system, there's still a faint chance of microbes on Mars or little fishy things in the deep oceans of Europa or Enceladus. So our very first alien meeting might be by microscope or remote camera. Those entities are also likely to be completely disinterested in meeting us, but at least they won't make any snarky remarks as we swoon in awe at such an historic meeting.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. One day we might meet aliens, or at least text them. And indeed, one day we might re-engineer how the sun works so as to keep our homeworld habitable, at least for a couple more billion years. The trick, of course, is to sustain our technological civilization long enough to get to those future opportunities. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just want to sustain the momentum, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll keep it coming for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.